your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is a continuation of our in-depth investigative reporting series on the JFK assassination. Today, a conversation with a woman who knew Lee Harvey Oswald intimately and romantically in 1963. She is Judith Ferry Baker. She was a young, promising science student who dreamed of finding a cure for cancer. However, her life path entered into a world of espionage after she was recruited to work in New Orleans in an underground biological research lab, and at the same time, she was romantically involved with Lee Harvey Oswald. And when she and he worked together at the Riley Coffee Company, and which lasted up until JFK assassination on November 22, 1963. Judith is also the author of Me and Lee, How I Came to Know, Love, and Lose Lee Harvey Oswald. Nice to have you with us today, Judith.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
There's much we can discuss together, but since we are limited in time, I'd like us to focus on the new insights and the new evidence of information related to the JFK assassination that you acquired while working on biological projects with Dr. David Ferry and Mary Sherman and Alton Ochsner and others, and your relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald, and also concerning the Warren Commission. We know the entire report is ridiculously outdated given the wealth of information that has been released during the last 50 years. So let's begin with the important issue of Lee Harvey Oswald's relationship with the CIA and the FBI, your relationship to him, and anything you share with me and this audience, please keep it in the first person, unless you're giving me information that was not first person, because that's different. We're going to trust that you have provided the documentation that on first person, you have inside knowledge. Once we step outside of first person, we can't guarantee that that knowledge is reliable. So let's begin with your relationship with Lee Harvey Oswald.
Well, Lee meant a great deal to me, even from the beginning, because I once had a relationship of a more academic nature with an older man. His name was Knute Mikkelsen. He was a spy in Hitler's underground. I learned a lot from him in the time I knew him, and I then began to admire spies. Upon meeting Lee, he exhibited all kinds of evidence that he had been a spy. It started with looking at his ring on his right hand. Most wedding rings are worn on the left hand, but not for people from the USSR or Hungary or other USSR captured countries at that time. I soon understood what kind of man he was, and he did tell me, and I would be like to share with you the information he gave me about his time in the USSR, for starters.
Fine.
Okay. Well, to begin with, Lee, right from the beginning, he actually did see the series I Led Three Lives. His brother Robert said he saw him in Texas, but Lee told me he saw them in New York, and he gave me the time schedule. To make a long story short, Lee had made contact with a customs officer at the border between Buffalo, New York, and Canada. His name was Charles Thomas. And through Charles Thomas, they let the boy across. He'd played hooky, and he wanted to sound so close to Canada. He was living in New York. He actually hitchhiked all the way when he was just 12 and a half and crossed the border there, and this customs agent let him do it. And they became friends, and Lee was watching I Led Three Lives, Herbert Philbrick's series, where Philbrick is an FBI informant, but he's pretending to be a communist and has infiltrated Communist Party's blocks in New York. And this was made into a popular series. So Philbrick became the father image for Lee Oswald, whose father died before he was born. And he just vowed he was going to do the same thing. So when he met the customs officer, Charles Thomas, By the way, I know their family. I've met them, and we've verified all these connections. He wanted to find out what he could do to serve his country. He began reading Marx and Engels and all that stuff, but he also was reading Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Paine and Leviathan and Hobbes and so on. So, you know, the Warren Commission doesn't report all the things that he actually studied when he's that young. And he did fulfill his dream because when he was 17, as soon as he was 17, he joined the Marines. He tried to join when he was 16, and he went to Atsugi eventually. That's in Japan, where they had the U2 program and also training CIA agents. And ONI, this is really Office of Naval Intelligence, he said. And he said it was borrowed by the CIA from the Office of Naval Intelligence. Now, during his time of training in Atsugi, he prepared himself, and he would even say, well, he told me that nobody beat him up for calling, he called everybody comrade. They knew he was studying the Russian language and so on. We find that he gets on his, well, I want to make this first person. To make a long story short, Lee Oswald throws his passport down at the embassy, U.S. embassy in Moscow. And if you did something like that today, say you're, if you went to the embassy in Iraq and threw your passport down and said, I'm going to tell all the secrets I know about how to down a drone, and they let you walk out and go to Iran to tell the story, I don't think you would ever get out of the building. But according to the official version, Lee walks right out. He leaves his passport there. Almost 3 years later, he comes back, picks it up, comes home with a loan, and he told him, here's a piece of new information. He wrote Governor, would be Governor Connally, but at that time he was Secretary of the Navy, complaining that he had been given an undesirable discharge. They had changed it after the fact because he didn't show up for reserves. He couldn't, of course, show up for reserves because he was a spy in the USSR. And he wrote the code word Hemingway in there. And this is because the new administration came along, and he had been actually marooned in the USSR. Now, he had been forced to marry a very nice lady, a young woman, who was the way to call him a honeypot, because she was dating all these so-called defectors. There were real defectors to the USSR, and then there were fake ones like Lee, who were there to gather information. Lee had to pretend to be a terrible shot so he wouldn't be presumably a sniper who was going to go and kill somebody. And there are other ploys he put on. He knew a lot more Russian than he let on. And then he learned a lot more when he was there. He constantly studied Russian. I was with him personally when he would go through his Russian flashcards. And at the university, the Tulane University listening room, I listened to him as he practiced his Russian to get a better accent, because his was a Belarusian accent that he had learned in Minsk, there in Belarus, and that's not quite what they spoke in Moscow, so he was trying to improve his Russian, even in New Orleans. So anyway, he comes back to the United States with this Marina that he had to marry so he wouldn't get deported. And he got her pregnant, even though they were going to get a divorce, got her pregnant in the U.S. so that she'd have a baby, and after the divorce, she wouldn't be deported. That way he could keep his baby that was born in the USSR. That baby's name was June Lee. And he'd be able to, of course, the other baby would be in the United States. And so they could divorce, and they wouldn't be deported. So we're talking about a man who intended to leave his wife. And I was in an unhappy relationship myself with my former husband, and basically he abandoned me in New Orleans most of the time, most of the summer, during some very rough times that occurred. And Lee really came to my rescue. In fact, we now realize, although he never quite said it that way, he said, I'm your protector, is what he told me. But, and then he said he was sent to New Orleans to spy on the program that we were working on, a biological weapons development program in order to kill Fidel Castro. The CIA has finally admitted they worked with the mafia, that they worked with other entities in order to devise various biological means to try and kill Castro so it wouldn't be linked to anybody or to any intention from the United States. So I was involved in that project, and I was very anti-Castro because I'd come from Florida, where all the Cubans had really just massed in. And I had even dated the former, Rufo Lopez Frasquet was the former finance secretary, the minister for Castro, and I was dating his son. So I knew a lot about the anti-Castro movement, and I was all for doing something about Castro, who had aimed his nuclear missiles at us, you know, at my family and me in Florida. And this Cuban Missile Crisis was only six months earlier when I was sent to New Orleans. Now, Lee was a spy in this to try and make sure that this project wouldn't get into the wrong hands. Especially, there was a concern that even though if this material was sent to Cuba and placed in Cuban hands, how could we guarantee it would stay in Cuban hands when they're teaming there with Russians? So Lee told me how he had worked very hard to get back. It took him several attempts because the new administration under Kennedy, Nixon administration, that is Eisenhower, but Nixon was running all this stuff, really didn't give the information over. So he had a hard time getting back, even though it looks like he came back quickly. After the letter with the code name of Hemingway in there helped a lot. You can look up Hemingway in Paris is the way.
Okay, Judith, I want to shift gears now.
Yes, sir.
So you've established that he was really spying for the United States.
Yes, he was.
Undercover when he went to Moscow, that he had mastered Russian, that that he was deeply patriotic, that he had a broad base of knowledge in areas that the Warren Commission and the media chose not to focus on. So now let's go down this track now.
Yes, sir.
You speak about how he was determined to try to prevent the assassination. Go into this in depth. From at what point were you aware that that there was an assassination effort against Kennedy? When were you aware that there was an assassination attempt against against Castro? Who were some of the cast of characters that you met through Oswald? And what did you know about them?
Okay, can we start with the beginning? Can you reiterate the first question and then one by one? I would appreciate that.
When did you first realize there was an attempt against...
Thank you. I first realized that something, that there was an effort to first kill Castro when I was still in Florida. There was considerable talk about that. And there were people there that I was aware of who were actively trying to kill Castro, and they were being co-sponsored by the biggest CIA camp that there was there in Miami. So when I came to New Orleans, what happened there is that I had a hatred for Kennedy because I'd been influenced by all these people. They were very disappointed about the Bay of Pigs, and many CIA people had been talking against Kennedy. So when then Lee Oswald straightened me out. He told me who was really responsible and how you can read about in JFK and the Unspeakable, another book, how treacherous the generals were and those that were working with Kennedy. He had to take the blame for a lot of things that he shouldn't have had to. And as Lee explained this and explained who Kennedy really was, he himself was involved with a lot of these anti-Castro people. He posed as pro-Castro only after about the middle of the summer. It was August by the time he started posing that way. Before that, he'd been working with Guy Bannister. And I know, because I was there, how he would work with Bannister on campuses. They were trying to find out who were the radicals were, who were... anti-segregation and pro-integration and so on. He's working with very conservative people. And Lee is learning a lot about these super conservative people because these people also hated Kennedy with a passion. And this included one of my doctors, Dr. Ochsner, and a lot of his group. And he was, of course, getting Cadillacs from Murchison all the time and was close to all the oil people. And we were very close to people who were talking constantly about they wanted to get rid of Kennedy because we were associated with David W. Ferry, who was, you can hear see him, kind of a parody of him, but not too bad, in the film JFK. This person was doing cancer research on the side and was a friend of Dr. Mary Sherman, who later would be viciously murdered on the day the Warren Commission came to get testimonies. So, in fact, all the people that I knew, almost all of them were murdered. I escaped, I think, because I was removed from the project a little before it was actually finished because of my ethical objections for using prisoners without their knowledge that they were being injected with cancer that would kill them if it was successful. I got kicked out for objecting to that. And that destroyed my cancer research career forever. Anyway, we had close connections with Texas, LBJ, things like that going on between all these ultra-conservatives. And Lee, armed with this information and the contact with David Ferry, was able to pretend to be a dumb grunt that they could manipulate and maneuver. He was actually very intelligent. And I was a great chess player and everything like that, but he would pretend to be a lot more stupid than he really was and sort of like a fly on a wall could hear a lot of things going on. And anyway, make a long story short, Lee actually was able to understand that by April that there were plans afoot to kill Kennedy. By May, he was certain of it, and I was by then involved with Lee, if romantically, and it didn't take too much longer before I understood what was going on. Lee did not want to tell me. He didn't want me to get hurt or, you know, by getting involved. But the fact of the matter is that the deeper he got into conservative territory, and this included posing as a pro-Castro kind of nut, you know, handing out handbills and things like that. Actually, Bannister was across the street, and others were, too. They're taking films. You can see some of those films. And they're actually watching who takes the pamphlets and who throws them away. The people who took them and held on to them, they got their pictures taken and, you know, followed and everything. I mean, things were very hot and hectic as far as espionage goes in New Orleans. It is the very seat of the Kennedy assassination plans and of the original group that started that.
Explain to the audience, Judith, who Guy Bannister was.
All right, Guy Bannister was a former chief of Chicago, of the FBI. I mean, I'm talking about ran 500 Chicago and area-based FBI officers. So he went down to New Orleans, and he got in trouble there with the police after uncovering for them a lot of the corruption. Once he uncovered the corruption, what Bannister told Lee and Lee told me. So Lee told me that Bannister was furious because they set him up so that he'd get fired. But he had a terrible temper. He was running his own private investigation office now, but he was closely associated with Bobby Kennedy. He was associated with the local CIA and FBI. Everybody knew each other. We're talking about every other person I met there was like an FBI informant. The place was loaded with this kind of people, spies, anti-spies, informants of all kinds, because this was a great port of entry for all of South America, Cuba, and all that. They had lost a lot when Cuba was cut off. You know, talking about Riley Coffee Company, they'd had associations with the FBI and CIA for years. In fact, Monahan that I was working for, he was a former FBI officer. So all these people are very in tight with each other. And they're trying to destroy Castro and get their banana republics in line again. And they're afraid that they would all turn communist. So everybody was focusing here on New Orleans. And then we have Kennedy. He's Bobby Kennedy. They've put out they're not going to do any more raid. They're going to raid using the FBI. They're going to raid all these anti-Castro training camps. So you've got a lot of hatred built up against Kennedy there. So openly, people are saying, you know, this one or the other saying Kennedy ought to be shot. So you could almost openly speak about all these things, and nobody would take it very seriously because everybody was saying that, at least in the people that I was associated with.
Judith, let's continue. Tell us about David Ferry, Mary Sherman.
All right. David Ferry was a mafia pilot near the end of his life. He was a fantastic pilot anyway. He worked for Eastern Airlines for 10 years. It was a big problem. He wanted to be a priest and had tried twice to do that. But he had been molested by priests. And anyway, he had nervous breakdowns over it. And he became a homosexual. And he said that was the reason. He just believed that's the way God made him. And he couldn't escape it. And he, however, was an extremely intelligent man who could fly anything upside down. anything that had wings, he could fly, I think even a mosquito. And that's how great he was. And he had very much ability also, could speak Spanish fluently, had many anti-Castro friends, and had trained a whole group of anti-Castro insurgents. And he said he was also out in Belchase. Now, that's about 3 miles outside of New Orleans, and that's where David Atlee Phillips was training. At Phillips at the CIA was Lee Oswald's handler, by the way. So we have a nexus of people connected together. That all happened in 62 by 63. A lot of that had calmed down. But now the focus, instead of on killing Castro, a lot of the focus of these people was now their energies were directed toward trying to see how they could kill Kennedy. And they would talk almost openly about this. David Ferry actually cried out that he hated Kennedy's guts and that he hoped he'd get killed or maybe she ought to get shot. And he said it so many times, everybody believed it. But he had changed his mind. Now he had to keep his ploy going because he'd been invited into the circles that were seriously interested in killing Kennedy. And these super conservative circles were connected to Dallas. So we have David Ferry here. He's a good pilot. He speaks all these different languages. Everybody knows him. He's trained half the Cuban pilots that ever came out of New Orleans. And this man is now privy to information, and they think he still hates Kennedy. But Kennedy is his fellow Catholic. Ferry voted for him. And when he found out more information, he realized that Kennedy was not to blame, really, for what happened, what came down at the Bay of Pigs. So now he's a listener. He's pretending that he's like that, but he's not. That's the thing that people don't understand.
Did you know David Ferry personally?
That's one reason David Ferry. Yes, of course I did. Yes, I spent hours with him. I was an atheist at the time. I'd been a Catholic. He spent hours trying to convince me that God existed and so on. David Ferry was, I consider that he probably saved my life. So,
how did he save your life?
Well, for one thing, I was sent back to Florida, but he called and told me that Santos Traficante was watching me to see, make sure if my name got in the paper, if my maiden name, V-A-R-Y, got in the paper, I'd probably get killed. So, I mean, he stuck his neck out for me, and he had good reason to. I mean, I had done some things to help him, too. And it's a long story. He and Mary Sherman admitted at Crippled Children's Hospital. But she found out he was associated with Dr. Robert Heath and with some psychoanalysis, and they were studying various drugs and things, the CIA was, for the MK-Ultra program. She was intrigued and wanted to know more. She didn't like Heath at all. Anyway, they became close friends. It turned out that David Ferry knew so much about science and drugs and so on, and even could do cancer research, which you'll see in the movie JFK. You'll see those mice running around in the cages there. Well, he knew so much that they realized, Dr. Mary Sherman and Dr. Ochsner, that he would be a great go-between to cut off. They had a ring of labs that was working on this biological weapon. It's a cancer weapon, SV40, based on SV40 monkey virus. And we were working with that stuff. But by breaking the ring, you couldn't make a trace from one lab to the other. So twice the ring was broken, once with at Dr. Mary Sherman's apartment and at David Ferry's apartment, where some of the activities went on that were the most easily handled. And I was involved at Dr. Mary Sherman's and at David Ferry's apartments. Preparing materials so they could be irradiated and selecting the biggest tumors and things like that and identifying them under the microscope and preparing test tube cultures of this material. And then it'd be sent back into the ring of labs. And they didn't really know where it came from. It was just a label and supposed to go to Dr. Mary Sherman and so on. So this way it kept this all as an underground activity.
Let's be clear on this. You, Judith Ferry Baker, as a promising scientist studying cures for cancer, you were also recruited to work on an underground project in biological research, and this was mainly to help find a way of killing Castro, right?
Well, when I was first noticed by Dr. Ochsner, Dr. George Moore, and by Dr. Harold Thiel, these people, that's American Cancer Society, the head of Roswell Park and Ochsner Clinic, and two Nobel Prize winners, Dr. Harold Urey and also Dr. Robert Robinson. These people had mentored me. I met them and I actually forced myself into a small convention that they were having and broke in there. Anyway, they got to see my work and they saw that I had created cancer, lung cancer in mice in only 7 days, which nobody had been able to do in all their fancy, expensive labs. So, I was only 16 and a half when I was able to do that, 17.
I don't want to get you off track here, but we have to summarize this. So, in other words, you had a promising career in science.
These men actually asked me, and it's in the newspapers, because all this is in the newspapers. My assignment was to make cancer more deadly. I had no idea that they were actually steering me into this. I thought by making cancer more deadly that we'd be able to find out how it grew and that better, and we'd be able to stop it, and that's the kind of excuse they gave me. Then I was lured into the Kill Castro project after the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything made me really hate Castro. So they had someone who was willing to work with them. I really regret it now.
Okay, but then you met Lee Harvey Oswald. And Lee Harvey Oswald was a...
He was sent to spy on the project, make sure it didn't get in the wrong hands.
Okay, and then through Oswald, you begin to meet David Ferry and Guy Bannister and all these kind of shady people working in the underground movement, in the anti-Castro movement. There was members of organized crime involved as well.
They wanted to kill Castro as well, so they were willing to provide finances under the table. That's how Jack Ruby came in, involved from Dallas.
Okay, now, did you meet Jack Ruby?
Yes, I did.
Okay, tell us about that, and let's try to keep it succinct.
All right, Jack Ruby was not a short, dumpy man like they're trying to say. He was the same height as Lee, 5'9", and well-muscled and all that. He was a fantastic person. He had a lot of charisma around him, and he treated me very well. He was there mainly to meet with Carlos Marcello, who was the godfather at that time in New Orleans, and who was running Dallas. They were very anti-Kennedy. Very anti-Castro, and we're cooperating with CIA to try to kill Castro. So they were involved in this, too.
Okay. Now, up to this point, what you have shared with us is that you knew people who were anti-Kennedy, that were working together with the anti-Castro movement, the organized crime headmaster out of New Orleans, but also handled that whole southwest part of the United States.
Yes.
And you were with Lee Harvey Oswald. That in and of itself does not prove that these people were going to kill Kennedy.
But,
give us the hard evidence that you have now. And
I think I have some hard evidence. We have, I'm wondering how I can express this best and succinctly as you want. Lee Oswald himself came from a mafia-oriented family. His mother dated the driver for Carlos Marcello. Lee, when he was arrested on August 9th for handing out pro-Castro pamphlets, they had a mob lawyer set his bail up for him. When Lee is arrested, even in Dallas, you have Dean Andrews, who is Carlos Marcello's lawyer, gets a call that he's supposed to go and represent Lee. But once, of course, Lee was accused of killing Kennedy, then they couldn't help him anymore on that. The mob was closely associated. Lee acted like Johnny Roselli. Johnny Roselli was a mobster who worked with the CIA. Lee, because he was CIA, that is ONI borrowed by the CIA, was a wonderful way to contact and stay in contact with the New Orleans elements of the mob. And that's how come I got to meet some of these people. So Lee was like a go-between.
Did at any time you hear either Jack Ruby or Guy Bannister or any of the other people involved in that group claim to be a part of conspiracy to kill Kennedy?
Yes, sir, they did.
Who? Which ones said they were part of it, and what did they tell you firsthand?
Well, the firsthand information I had came from David Ferry, and he said that he was involved with Carlos Marcello, who hated hated Kennedy because Bobby Kennedy, of course, had kidnapped him and dumped him over in Central America and almost killed him. He came back with a fierce desire to murder Kennedy. He didn't realize he had to murder the president in order to get rid of Bobby Kennedy. Now, that was direct information I got from David Ferry. David Ferry said he had helped Marcello at one point in getting away, not maybe from the beginning, but getting out of there and getting back to the USA, and Marcello rewarded him by hiring him to work for G. Ray Gill, his own personal most important lawyer. So you have Dave is working there with the mob lawyer, and he's getting a lot of information through that. And we know that the mob was involved in killing Kennedy, but they did it with the approval of, and this is from David Ferry, from those in Texas, and we're talking about Lyndon Johnson. I know this is shocking to you, but it's true.
So David Ferry, who plays...
And so he has to die eventually, and yeah, they kill him too.
But he specifically told you that Lyndon Johnson and other individuals in Texas were behind the conspiracy to kill Kennedy?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
And on top of that, we have Lee Oswald telling me that his handler, David Atlee Phillips, this is the name he told me to remember, but also to remember the names of Billy Solestes and Bobby Baker, that it wasn't they themselves who were responsible for Kennedy's death, but because of them. And you can look, and I don't want to go to secondhand records, but the fact is that these scandals were going to remove Lyndon Johnson from office. You can see the whole testimony of that in the Men Who Killed Kennedy series. That's episode 9, called The Guilty Men, where we can establish for a fact that Lyndon Johnson knew and pretended he didn't, and pretended to be scared and everything else, knew what was coming down. And we have a lot of witnesses for that. So, of course, I trust what David Ferry told me.
Did you know David Ferry to lie?
Oh, yeah. Of course he would. But because when you have to understand, he wouldn't lie about something like that. I mean, his lies would be silly jokes or something. And right. He pretended to be straight, for example, when he was a homosexual. I mean, things like that going on.
Okay.
But we were quite close.
Okay. Now, there were many people that were murdered or died under unusual circumstances who were involved. Go through the people that you knew who were killed and give us what you know about that. And did they fear after Kennedy's assassination that they would be killed?
Well, no, we separated ourselves from each other as quickly as we could because one could lead to the other. So we were not in contact with each other. Compartmentalization was everything. In other words, a lot of these people I may have just heard of later, but definitely, for sure, we'll go down one line. And that is Dr. Mary Sherman, my friend. I recently got her, her autopsy and her death photos. And just as Edward Haslam said in his book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, you will see that her arm was completely vaporized off by an electrical discharge of some millions of volts, and that she's, yet her hair hasn't even caught on fire. It's the most horrible, horrifying picture. Mary Sherman was murdered on July 21st, 1964, the same day the Warren Commission came to get testimonies there. So that was the front page here of this gruesome murder. She had many knife wounds. She's found naked and on fire and all this kind of thing. But the fire wasn't caused there, as you can see in the photos.
Why would she have been interviewed by the Warren Commission? What was her role to play in the Kennedy assassination?
Well, here's what it was. She was giving aid and medical care, for example, to all the anti-Castro people out there. It was known that she was working with Dr. Ochsner and knew Clay Shaw, that she went with Ochsner on trips to Central and South America. And we have Juan Valdez and others who would have been able to testify. So what I'm trying to say is Mary Sherman would have spoken out, and she would have explained just what the problem was with why people weren't speaking out in New Orleans. I believe she would have spoken out. I know that she was working with Lee Oswald when we have an informant named Lee who contacted the FBI in Chicago, and that's where Mary Sherman came from, saving Kennedy's life 3 weeks before he finally died, before he's finally murdered. And Mary Sherman had a lot of contacts there, as did Dr. Ochsner. And Lee Oswald according to Abraham Bolden, he's Secret Service agent, he was present when he heard that this person named Lee saved Kennedy's life, and the Secret Service was asked to if they'd like to get involved with the investigation there, and they turned it down. So we can find a lot of information about Mary Sherman and how closely she was connected with information that she had. Now, besides Mary Sherman, who was found dead, Guy Bannister was found dead the month before, in May. So we're talking about in June. So July, we have the death of Mary Sherman. Guy Bannister, they find him dead. They say it's a heart attack, but he's got a bullet in his back, sir. All right, from everybody I've talked to who knew him personally, and I did contact some of these people. Then before that, his pilot, Hugh Ward, who had flown Lee to Houston so he could go eventually over across the border to Mexico City with a biological weapon, Hugh Ward died the month before that, in May. So you've got three in a row there, right there in New Orleans. But there are others who died, too. My landlady, her name was Susie Hanover, weeks after I left New Orleans, she vanishes, completely vanishes from the record. We have Richardson, Mrs. Richardson, the pastor's wife who knew Lee and me, she died 17 days after the assassination. These people were witnesses who knew about me and Lee. Others, though, survived. They fled from New Orleans, like Anna Lewis. She, Anna Lewis and David Lewis, dated with me and Lee, and she's on record for that. You can find it on YouTube, you know, the testimony of Anna Lewis. And so there are others, the Charles Thomas family. Most of these people, however, were murdered.
How about David Ferry?
David Ferry, they said that he died 5 days after his name is in the paper and he's going to be asked to testify. 5 days after his name is in the paper, he's found dead, supposedly of natural causes from a burst berry aneurysm. Now, I've been trained medically, and I know this stomach contents. This is supposed to be a forensic autopsy, and, sir, it was not. They never analyzed the contents of the stomach, but they did notice that it had coffee or what looked like coffee in it with lots of particles of vegetable matter. Now, unless he was chewing on lettuce and drank coffee at the same time, the only other explanation is that a lot of pills were forced down his throat because the binder of pills causes these little pieces of particles to show up in the stomach contents. We know that there are marks around David Ferry's mouth. There are autopsy photos. They will not let us see that people have viewed where they can see bruises inside his mouth. We find that his false teeth were in the living room instead of in his bedroom. He's found naked in bed, just like Mary Sherman was found naked, just like Guy Bannister was found naked. They have this kind of modus operandi, apparently.
How about Hugh Ward?
Hugh Ward was flying the Lesseps to Morrison, who was the mayor of New Orleans, who was also knew about this information, a lot of this information. He was flying in Mexico when his plane exploded, and that was the end of him.
All right. Did you know
about? And you know that I knew these people. I knew what they knew. Hugh Ward had been trained as a pilot by David Ferry, by the way.
All right, we're coming up to the end of this segment. Give us your insight now of from all that you have done in your research and your first person with all these cast of characters, because very few people knew personally, had long conversations with David Ferry and Mary Sherman and Alton Ochsner and Guy Bannister. All of these people are related to the JFK assassination. You knew them. You spoke with them. Why do you feel that you weren't killed?
Well, first of all, I was Jay Ferry in New Orleans, and a lot of people didn't know that Dave was a homosexual, was working with a girl, and the name Jay could have sounded like a man anyway, but he called me Jay and Jay Ferry, but there's also Jay Ferry and Dave Ferry. If you weren't alert, you might think you heard Dave Ferry when it was Jay Ferry. Now, when I was sent back to Florida and I was placed in a Peninsular Chem Research, so they put me in a high-class research lab before completely kicking me out so it wouldn't connect to New Orleans. There I was Mrs. Robert Ellison Baker III. And as long as I kept my V-A-R-Y, out of the paper, so I couldn't go to my sister's wedding, I couldn't go to my grandparents' funerals and so on because I was afraid to get my name in the paper. I kept my mouth shut for 36 years.
What about the information that we have now that Lee Harvey Oswald had a half-brother who was high up in the intelligence agency.
Well, that half-brother was working in a pathology lab run by the U.S. government, U.S. Army, in San Antonio at the same time. So you never hear of John Pick. They never mention that. They don't mention that Lee Oswald's favorite subject in high school was biology. And I could go on and on about the intelligence of this family and their connections with the government and with the mafia.
All right. Well, we appreciate you sharing these insights with us. Well,
I want to say that the Warren Commission is out of date by 50 years. We have had 5 million new documents released. People like myself, I'm not the only one standing out there. We've got Edward Haslam in his book, Dr. Mary's Monkey, analyzed me and beat me around and made sure who I was. I'm telling you that he spent 2 decades. He's a native of New Orleans, and he came to the same conclusions I'm telling you right now.
I think a lot of people are coming to conclusions that challenge the Warren Commission, and rightly so. We have a lot of forensic evidence today that shows that Lee Harvey Oswald could not have been the lone shooter. And when was the last time you saw Lee Harvey Oswald alive?
Well, that's horrible, because the last time I saw him alive was on television just before he got shot.
I'm talking about before that, in person.
That was a horrible experience for me. Well, the last time I saw him was approximately September 2nd, 1963. We were driving away, and he was standing in the corner pretending to read a paper, and we looked into each other's eyes. But we were in contact with each other, sir, until 37 and a half hours before the assassination. We're talking about around midnight Wednesday going into Thursday morning. And he told me then that he was afraid he was going to die. I wanted to kill myself when I heard that. And he said, no, you've got to stay alive. You've got to tell my family, tell my children who I really was.
Did you know Marie Oswald?
I'll put it this way. I knew plenty about her because I'm the other woman. And, you know, the guy's going to say a lot of things. So I don't really want to go there because it's not fair. We're all different now, many years later. And the woman who was Marina Oswald then, is not the same woman that we have today. So one thing is for sure, you don't see her complaining about or commenting about what I've written. She knows that they didn't have a very good marriage and that he was all the time saying, well, you can go back to Russia, you know, that kind of thing. That it was completely incompatible marriage. And as for me, I had a husband who actually sent me a postcard when he was in New Orleans and didn't bother to see me. That's the kind of husband I had. I was newly married to him. So we gravitated to each other, and I want to tell you, he was a wonderful guy. It's not anything like the Warren Commission has put. All the photographs you see of him, by the way, I mean, I have one of him ironing diapers. So we have a lot of photographs. There are people. He's always around people. He liked people. He liked animals. And he was not anything like you would imagine. You don't find anybody in the Marines saying that he was a bad guy. You know, he started that spy career over there by dating a girl in the Queen Bee. He's only got like $50 a month, and yet he's dating a girl that costs like $40 every time you see her, and yet he takes her to the base. She's his girlfriend. They fell in love, and he had to leave her behind, but she gave him a lot of information. That was his first spy assignment. It was in Tokyo. These are things people don't know.
But he told you, or did he ever show you any documentation to prove that he was a spy for the United States government?
Well, let's put it this way. First of all, he had me meet Charles Thomas when he got his passport in only 24 hours. How can a guy who's been in the USSR for almost three years puts on his passport application that he intends to return to Cuba right there in broad daylight? This is during the height of the Cold War. I meet the man I met him personally, to Charles Thomas. He had tattoos on his fingers and an accent and so on. And he says, this is the man they flew in from Miami so I can get my passport expedited. And they expedited a stack of them along with it so it wouldn't look unusual. Now, he did this because he wanted to prove to me who he was, because, of course, I was suspicious. What if he were someone who had turned? He said the only person he was really afraid of was Jesus. And that was James Jesus Angleton, his handler, when he was over there. Because he said he had been actually interrogated by the KGB over there, and he never told the CIA because he was afraid they might kill him. Because he said, they're suspicious because I didn't come back in a coffin from the USSR. So, you know, he suspected from the beginning of the time I knew him that they might just use him, you know, position him any way they wanted to.
Wasn't it also the case that he went into Mexico to carry some biologically active materials that were supposed to be picked up by a courier to take into Cuba to kill Castro, but the courier didn't show up, and there was a short lifespan on that material that he was taking to give the courier? Is that not the case?
It's absolutely the case, and that's why, of course, he came back before his visa expired, his tourist visa. And that's why when he did get his, by the way, that Cuban transit visa did come through, but he was in Dallas. He ignores it. Why? Because the project's over. Instead of being, you know, thrilled, oh, I've got it, now I'm going to go to Cuba, he ignores it. That's one of the proofs I can show you that this was a project that he was in and it was now over with.
So let's just summarize what we've learned today. That Lee Harvey Oswald, according to you, you and he had a highly romantic relationship.
We did.
That you were working as a scientist, that you were of the belief that the Kennedys were not good because you were surrounded in a culture at a very young and formidable age of people who were vehemently anti-Kennedy, and that in that circle you met Lee Harvey Oswald. Oswald had claimed to you that he was an agent for the United States government, that he was working as a courier, in effect, to get biologically active materials into the hands of people in Mexico who would then transport it into Cuba to try to assassinate Kennedy.
And he was also cleaning out pro-Castro spies by pretending to be pro-Castro himself, and they photographed him. He started the FPCC organization, Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and they rounded up several pro-Castro spies using these ploys. They never even held a single meeting. He didn't have to. They just come to the office and they go and arrest him, plant drugs on him, beat him up, and send him back to Cuba.
And then you also were close to the people involved in the assassination because they made statements they were involved in the assassination.
Oh, Bannister despised Kennedy. He could hardly speak his name without turning red in the face. The hatred is just poured out of these people.
But you knew Bannister. Lee Harvey Oswald knew Bannister.
Yes, and that's true. But, you know, Lee was working for him as Bannister's such an anti-communist person. Remember, Oxner was a co-founder with Ed Butler of the INCA, the Information Council of Americas. That was a CIA-sponsored propaganda arm they used all over Central and South America. They sent radio programs down there. And so Lee was on one of these radio programs. They never sent that one out, but they used that later on a record, you know, called... They really betrayed me in so many ways. It's sickening to me.
I need a quick answer on this because we're at the end of our program. Have you been threatened since coming out with this information by anyone within the government or any of its intelligence agencies?
Well, not from the government, but I've received threats and threats that. I get a threat like one of them was, do you want to have another accident? And I sent that to everybody. I was afraid to go to work, and that night I was in the hospital again. So, I mean, in the History Channel, the documentary, The Love Affair, I was hospitalized before and after. It kept getting hit by cars or vans. Anyway, to make a long story short, I finally had to move overseas to save my life. And also my friends were being threatened, my family, and many things were stolen. My dog was shot. I've had many bad things happen, so I will not be coming back probably to the United States. I feel safe overseas. I haven't been harmed overseas. I do get a lot of problems when I go through airports. Terrible things happen in airports.
Judith, we're out of time. Thank you very much, Judith Baker, for being on and sharing your insights.
Well, God bless you. Thank you very much.
I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the continuation of our series on the JFK assassination.
Thank you.